Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Roya Hakakian, who is an Iranian-American poet, journalist, writer, and television producer for programs like 60 Minutes. She gained notoriety for her 2004 memoir, Journey from the Land of No. Her latest book is Assassins of the Turquoise Palace, a nonfiction account of the Mykonos restaurant assassinations of Iranian opposition leaders in Berlin. Roya Hakakian is the founding member of the Iranian Human Rights Documentation Center and serves on the board of Refugees International. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roya Hakakian.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And I'm so sorry that we've had such a rough day here. Our first live guest showed up not live. And we had to go to a recorded segment, and then he finally showed up again. He was arrested on Capitol Hill this week, so I thought it was an important story to cover. So my apologies for, and thank you for your patience.
No worries.
So this has been quite a week for the rumors of war vis-a-vis an Israeli strike on Iran and the extent to which the U.S. will either have to sit it out.
Has there been an unquiet week
That's
for
true.
Iran and Israel in the past couple of years?
That's true. But this, I think in terms of rumors of war, the rumors are flying thick and fast. I refer to David Ignatius' interview with Defense Secretary Leon Panetta in the Washington Post, where Leon Panetta said he believes there's a strong likelihood that Israel will strike Iran in April, May, or June. That strikes me as coming from such a senior official that perhaps all the administration can do at this point, since they've told the Israelis privately that they don't want to attack, and the Israelis have not given the assurance that they won't, that, and you know, if it happens during an election year, the Republicans are going to be screaming to join our best ally and all that stuff. So is this all the administration can do, is publicly warn the American people that they don't want to get involved in an attack?
Well, I suppose so, because given the economic conditions in the United States and the two wars, Afghanistan and the one in Iraq, and the fact that they have so deeply drained the American resources, I just can't see how we as Americans could afford to take on any further operations. And I think such a stomach for starting another war, which seems especially unnecessary, is something that Americans don't have right now. So I think on this front, it's a very hard sell to the public.
But two analysts I've spoken to have pointed out that the only likely way that a Republican will get elected president, given the fratricide between the two leading candidates, Romney and Gingrich, and the rising popularity of Obama and the good news on the economy, at least that's how the White House is spinning it, that the only way that you could bring this guy down is to have a little war, let him hang out to dry while the Republicans rush to the aid of their friend Netanyahu, and gas prices go through the ceiling.
Right. I mean, I think this is sort of the typical conspiratorial scenarios that always fly just about this time in pre-election season in America. If you remember, you know, back in 1979, 1980, the hostages in Iran had been taken, and there was also a pre-election debate as to what Iran was going to do and how the Iranian politics vis-a-vis the hostages was going to affect Carter and Reagan. So to me, kind of looking at this from a historic perspective, there's nothing new. Iran has been staging these very dramatic political schemes since 79 and trying to, in effect, influence to some degree American elections, American politics by creating unrest. And I think ultimately what it comes down to is for the world community to decide how and whether it wants to deal with a situation and with a regime like the Iranian regime, which has only been consistent in one way, which is in creating unrest and in creating havoc. And you know, as an Iranian and as a human rights activist, I am very much dissatisfied by this whole nuclear debate, because I feel that it detracts attention from all the other worthy subjects going on in Iran, namely the Green Movement, the human rights violations, and it really casts a shadow on all the other things that should, in my view, be on the forefront.
Again, I'm speaking with Roya Hakakian, who's an Iranian-born poet, journalist, writer, and television producer with programs like 60 Minutes. Her latest book is Assassins of the Turquoise Palace, and she's a founding member of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center and serves on the board of Refugees International. Well, I won't belabor it, but you know, there is a history here, as you mentioned, the October surprise, which Gary Sick, who was there in the White House, has written about. Mm-hmm. And prior to that, there was an example during the Vietnam War where Henry Kissinger, who was later became the National Security Advisor, secretly met through the offices of Chiang Kai-shek's widow, Madam Chiang Kai-shek, with the South Vietnamese to dissuade them from joining the peace talks, which were thus scuttled, and that certainly helped in Nixon's election. So they, in this country, in spite of often the calls for bipartisanship, I think sometimes things get quite ruthless politically. Now, to talk about the Iranian leadership causing trouble, surely the Iranian leadership, would they want one of these Republicans who can't wait to bomb the place?
I think, in a way, the regime would like a war. I think that in many ways the regime would welcome a war, because it's their only way to their survival / salvation. I think there is nothing left for the regime to hang its ideological hat on anymore. After 33 years, the regime has really, in many ways, lost its legitimacy, especially since the post-election drama of 2009. And I think, you know, the fact that the Supreme Leader moved to the side of the illegitimate candidate or, you know, installed President Ahmadinejad, it was a major blow to all those who still had some kind of a respect or belief in the office of the Supreme Leader. And therefore, I think the only thing that can, in some ways, save the regime is a major war with a major country like the United States, so that they can go back to all the, you know, fabulous, dramatic rhetoric that has, since 1979, enabled them to be in the forefront of ideological warfare, in the forefront of Islamic martyrdom and ideological debates of such. And I think this would be a great help to them, which is why I and a lot of other Iranian exiles like myself believe that the best thing to do is not give them that opportunity, so that they fall on their own, they collapse on the weight of their own evil.
Well, it's true that they would be helping this regime. I think that's universally accepted by the more sensible analysts. It also would be enormous help to Bashar al-Assad, who is under enormous pressure. And as you've seen, the Russians and the Chinese vetoed a modest attempt by the UN Security Council to do something about the unmitigated brutality and bloodshed at the hands of this hideous regime. So let me go back there to 79 and to get a sense of, and you've written about just a part of this big picture of state-sanctioned assassinations on the part of the Iranian regime, assassins of the Turquoise Palace. The when they took over the U.S. Embassy, of course, that was crossed a threshold, causa belli. Normally, that is an act of war when you take diplomats hostage. So from day one, it seems that they were playing by their own rules. Is that a fundamental fact that the Supreme Leader, whether it's the Khomeini or the Khamenei of the moment, that they literally have reserved the right to play by their own rules?
Absolutely. Which is why I oftentimes hear from foreign, you know, Western experts, oh, we've had very, very good opportunities to make good with Iran, and it was very unfortunate that we missed those opportunities, as if the Iranian regime, you know, since its inception, had ever behaved in a logical, predictable fashion. So therefore, to make it justified that the loss of an opportunity was a major blow. I don't think there has ever been an opportunity, the facade of an opportunity, yes, but not a real one, a genuine one. And I think that's in part what the West reads wrong about Iran, that the West fails to see the irrationality of the regime, the fact that they really do, as you put it, play by their own rules, because and that rule, at the heart of that rule is the notion of chaos. They create chaos because they thrive on chaos, because chaos is the key to their survival. And I think part of what you know, in a way, now that we're reviewing Iranian history, part of what brought about the fatwa against Salman Rushdie in 1989 was that all the other elements of chaos in Iranian history had been eliminated. You know, the hostages had been freed in 81, the war with Iraq had ended in 88, and the regime needed something new. It needed some new reason for havoc, and the fatwa against Rushdie came out of that.
But there were 500 other fatwas, weren't there, by Ayatollah Khomeini? Didn't he have a list of people he wanted to kill, and they went about doing it methodically around the world?
Yes, absolutely. And that's really why I wanted to write this new book, because as much as I, as a writer, respect and love Salman Rushdie and his prose and his contributions to bringing out, being the voice of, you know, the third world in this era, in 20th century, in some ways, I also think that he has also eclipsed in some way, unwillingly, of course, the story behind his own fatwa, which has been that he was not the first. He was not the first writer against whom a fatwa was issued, that as early as 1979, when Ayatollah Khomeini came to power, he drew a list of 500 500 names of Iran's best intellectuals, writers, artists, and opposition leaders. And the regime went about for at least 9 years, you know, killing wherever they were of these Iranians who were dissidents living in Europe, even in the United States and elsewhere. And, you know, the international community, mostly Europe, turned a blind eye to these incidents. And we came in the West to learn about the word fatwa only with Salman Rushdie, and only in 89, when it was issued on the life of a British citizen.
Well, let's go then to the current Supreme Leader, Khamenei. I mean, he has a little bit more education, doesn't he, not than Khomeini did in terms of the outside world. Although, as crazy as that assassination attempt it was supposed to happen on Georgetown restaurant, where they were going to blow up or assassinate the Saudi ambassador, which I've looked into, and everybody that I talked to said, no, it's for real. It sounds crazy, but it's actually for real. Right. So is it possible? Give me a sense of what kind of fatwas this guy's, the current guy's putting out.
Well, you know, this is very, very funny to me, because there was, for a period of 2-3 weeks after that allegation came out, that a slew of experts started to say, this is impossible, this is impossible. And what seemed to me most reasonable was to say, okay, what is the moral that we want to draw from this incident? Is it to say whether, you know, for legal purposes, for the purposes of a court, I'm sure, you know, the prosecutors and everyone need to establish whether this man from Corpus Christi actually was trying to carry out this operation. Yes, I understand that. But is the broader purpose to establish whether Iran is behind this or not, you know, one man is immaterial. Because in the perspective of, again, this 33-year history, Iran has been behind so many other assassinations against its own citizens that, you know, whether the Saudi ambassador was among those people that they had in mind to kill is irrelevant and immaterial and insignificant. And so, you know, from the standpoint of someone like me who really cares about the history of Iran and those who have perished in these operations, you know, the question of who was behind the killing of the Saudi ambassador is almost, you know, again, insignificant.
The planned killing.
You know, why would they want to do this now? Is that what concerns you?
No. I'm just getting a sense of whether this is a continuum from the Ayatollah
to the current crime. I think they're in a jam politically, and they're looking for ways to revive themselves. And one of the best ways that they can revive themselves is by going back to the very things that put them in international headlines from the early days of their birth. Mm-hmm. And those are, you know, the big dramatic acts like the takeover of the American embassy, like the fatwa. And I think there is, in a way, given that they are between a rock and a hard place, I suppose, the best thing to do is to go back to what they were good at and what they knew, to sort of return to their own radical origins. And that's what I see in it. I mean, there are lots of people who say there are rifts within the Revolutionary Guards, within the elite ranks of the regime, and therefore, mm-hmm. you know, this is kind of an act of rebellion by one faction within the regime against another. Yes, you know, I think what I don't like about this particular analysis is that this sort of analysis always leaves room for us to think that then there are some good guys and there are the bad guys, and if only we as the international community do something to get rid of the bad faction, then the good faction comes out.
Right, we have to resort to diplomacy. What I'm getting from you, Roy, we have to wrap it up now, is a sort of dreadful sense that there's a kind of symbiosis between the determination on the part of right-wing Israelis to attack Iran and the determination on the part of these lunatics in charge of Iran who want war. So it's not a very good picture altogether. I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Roy Hakakian, an Iranian-born American poet, journalist, writer, and television producer with programs like 60 Minutes. She's the author of Assassins of the Turquoise Palace and is a founding member of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center and serves on the board of Refugees International. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with one of the founders of the Occupy movement.
ای فدای آن همه عطر و بوی تو هر زمان دل می کشد پر به سوی تو هر کجا پا می نهم سر فرود آرم قبله گاه من شده خاک کوی